first Landwise webcast. And just a bit of background, the COVID beast forced cancellation of our conference. But with the support from the sponsors and others, we have been able to develop and present our Landwise online podcasts and webcasts. So we do want to thank the Platinum sponsors, because our conference sponsors left their support with us even when we cancelled the conference. So BASF Crop Protection and the Hawke's Bay Regional Council have been our Platinum sponsors for many years now. And Gold sponsors Processed Vegetables New Zealand, Vegetables New Zealand and Potatoes New Zealand, Balance Agri-Nutrients and Horizons Regional Council. And also our long-term conference sponsors Upatu Farms, Biostart and Plant and Food. And the other thing for us to just say is that we're really delighted to be working with Access Radio Kidnappers to record and produce the podcasts. So you can get the podcasts via Radio Kidnappers, the Landwise website, Spotify or Apple Podcasts. So there's lots of options for things. So I'm Dan Bloomer, founder and manager of Landwise, and I've got a really strong focus on sustainable production, especially regarding soil and water, and especially in the arable and horticulture sectors. So I'm also interested in agritech development and assessment, and what I look for is solutions that can help achieve wins for farmers, again, particularly in that sustainable food production area. So we'll just let the few clicks of people come on board. New people, we're just asking if you turn your video camera and your microphone off to save bandwidth, and so people in rural areas can get a slightly better listen to things. Thank you. So I thought in order of podcast publication, we'd introduce the presenters. So 30 seconds on who are you, Jay Clark?
Yeah, g'day, Jay Clark. I'm a director of Woodhaven Gardens. We're a large leafy green vegetable grower in the Horowhenua. We are farming on around about 2,500 acres and cropping that around about 1.5, 1.6 times a year, doing 23 different fresh vegetable crops and then a couple of catch crops on top of that with maize and ryegrass just for environmental purposes. And I think we're estimated to produce around about 10, maybe a little bit more, maybe closer to 15% of the leafy green vegetable supply in New Zealand.
Thanks, Jay. Luke Postuma.
Hi, I'm Luke. I've been with Landwise now for the last year, working as an extension agronomist. And so a lot of my job's been running on-farm trials with growers, and then supporting those growers working with growers to help them have confidence when they're looking at making on-farm change with their nutrient practice. Before that, I spent the last 3 years doing soil mapping and a lot of soil testing for quite a bit in New Zealand. So I mean, I was on the road but before coming to Landwise.
Thanks, Luke. And Georgia?
Yep. So I'm Georgia, I'm the extension coordinator at Landwise. So as well as helping Luke with on-farm trials, I'm also supporting growers with nutrient management, overseer, and organising field days, the conference, and stuff like this.
Thanks, Georgia. And Charles Murfield, known globally as Murph.
Indeed. Thank you very much, Dan. So my background, originally studied horticulture, got into organics as a manager, and then jumped the fence over onto the science side. So I've got a background in one of the sustainable ags, i.e. organics, working as in research and extension now. And so bringing a lot of the lessons I've learnt in organics and the research side of that over the years now over to mainstream agriculture to help assist with the challenges and opportunities we've got ahead of ourselves.
Sweet. Thank you, Murph. So that is the panelists that you've got addressing you today, people. And so what I'm going to ask each of them to do now is a one-minute synopsis of what they talked about in their podcast to refresh our memories. For some of us, it's been several weeks since we possibly heard one of the first ones from Jay. So can I come back to you again, Jay, and just what was the thing that you were talking about? What was your key message?
Yeah, I was saying to Dan, buddy, I can barely remember this morning, let alone what we did a couple of weeks ago on the podcast. But I think the general probably theme of my presentation was focusing on two areas, was making sure that you have community buy-in to what you do. I don't know whether or not there ends up being regional councillors listening to this, I don't know, but I'm a big believer that we've got to work on outcomes that our communities actually want to see. Rather than just put in place things that help you tick a box for compliance purposes. If we don't get that social license to operate, we don't get community buy-in, it doesn't matter whether you've achieved a council regulation or not, because that will inevitably end up changing if the community isn't satisfied with the results. So focusing on that stakeholder engagement, I think, is really, really important. The other one is that there is no recipe, there's no rule book for this, and that everything will be different for everybody's individual properties, their individual farms, and their type of farming system. I think we've got Murph on the call today, who's an organic farmer, I'm sure he'll be the first to acknowledge that there's environmental challenges that are different in organic farming from conventional farming. There'll be environmental challenges that are different in growing vegetables from growing sheep and beef or dairy farming. There'll be different environmental challenges based on where you're located in the country. So coming up with a plan that works for you, for your farming system and your individual properties is really important.
So Jay, one of the things that I took from your talk is that it sounded as though a data-driven farm plan that met community hopes was the key, and that's how you felt you would be meeting regulatory requirements largely, if not totally, just through that process alone.
Yeah, I think it depends on whose version of regulation you're talking about, Dan. If we end up looking at what's in the NES freshwater and the stress for farm plans, especially for horticulture, and steering horticulture more down that track, then 100% that sort of data-driven approach helps you tick that box, because you'll need to demonstrate your versions of good management, best management practice. In terms of just data capture as a theme, I think it's really important to understand that if you're not even doing that step, if you're not understanding what you are doing, you can't understand what impact you're having. And if you can't understand what impact you're having, then how are you going to put in good or best management practices that are going to attempt to mitigate that? So having the ability to capture your data, know what your inputs are versus what your yields are across your farming system is really, really important. And I think it's also important for farmers to know that that's not just beneficial in terms of compliance, it helps you run a better business. When you start to capture all that information, you can then start to really look at the profit and loss of individual parts of your business, individual crops, and at what time of year, and structure a much more profitable enterprise, because you can see what makes sense and what doesn't from a financial perspective, as well as having a look at your data to see where you may be having the bigger environmental impacts.
So you've got a strong data background, like you've had a career as a data guy, and Do you think other farmers will slot into that sort of approach easily?
I think they won't if they just believe it's 100% compliance driven. If you've got a farmer who's thinking, well, I've got a record, especially say in horticulture where we're highly intensive, we're not just putting fertilizer down say once a year as a top up when a pasture's looking a little bit poor, or we want to get a bit of extra growth for some extra feed. You know, putting fertilizer down and harvesting different crops is a daily activity on a commercial vegetable growing operation. So there is a large amount of work that goes into that data capture process. And if people think that it's just ticking a compliance box, then I think there'll be a lot of pushback. And one of the things that I've talked to different growers about, and I've talked to MFE and MPI about, is actually making sure that whatever systems are made available to growers to do the appropriate data capture, there's additional added value as a business management tool. being able to do crop P&Ls for different times of year, for different seasons, across different crops, and compare all that stuff and structure your business so that you get the most profitable outcome for you and you know, your stakeholders, is a real added benefit that you can get from having really good data capture.
So that sounds a bit like the LandWise mantra of sustainable production that gives you better environmental and economic outcomes. You can't split it up and do one or the other. You've got to have them tangled together.
100%. And that has been maybe where I think some regulators or central government has had a bit of a miss in their communication, because that, you know, we all know the story that if you're clean and green, it gives you the ability to market. Well, you come to the likes of commercial vegetable growing in New Zealand, where a commodity business, very low margin. We're not trying to sell a premium product. We're trying to put healthy food on the table at a reasonable price so that people can access that healthy food. And it's a different marketing sort of structure than, say, selling premium New Zealand lamb to the UK. So the story about the added benefit of environmental compliance hasn't necessarily rung true with maybe all growers in our industry, because it doesn't necessarily ring true in our market. But if you can paint a different picture to say, well, look, by going through this process, you're going to understand your business better. You're going to make better business decisions, and that's going to help you be a more profitable business. All of a sudden, you've got that instant buy-in that's going to push growers to say, yeah, that rings true to me. And, you know, if I do that, I can see a real added benefit for my business.
Thanks, Jay. Luke, can I sort of drag you to the front for a moment?
Yeah.
Again, it was a couple of weeks ago that you got interviewed, but can you remember what you talked about and revise us?
Yeah, so most of my talk was about the farm trials we've been doing over the summer with growers. We've been doing some trials of summer crops up in Gisborne, so there's particularly with tomatoes and sweet corn, and then some other work with some the brassica crops in the Horowhenua. And I think probably the main findings or the main message we took away from those trials were the value of soil testing and pre-side dressing, like taking soil tests before side dressing. So we'd set up quite a few trials looking at different rates of fertilizer. And then, so we're taking a soil sample right at planting or before planting and decided on fertilizer rates and different treatments. And then it came to side dressing, in particular the sweet corn crops, and we got very little yield response when we went back and looked at the numbers afterwards, there'd been quite a bit of mineralization for the late of the soil nitrogen for the late sweet corn crops, and we didn't actually need much side dressing last summer. And that's probably because of the winter had been quite dry as well, so there wasn't as much leaching as normal. But so I suppose it's talking about the on-farm trials we've been doing with growers, and the purpose of the trials has been to get engagement with the growers we're working with to, I suppose, help them validate on their farm new farm practices or what ways of, so a key focus of this project we're working on is how do we be smarter with the fertilizer we're applying, so just putting on the fertilizer we actually need, and soil testing is quite a key part to that process. So it's how do you give growers confidence to potentially reduce their rates and put their trust in a soil test.
Okay, thanks, Luke. There are a couple of things from your talk that grabbed me. Was you've addressed some of them now already, but it was the idea that, you know, why do we do a trial with a farmer in a project like future-proofing vegetable production? And we do want to learn things, but it's also about the engagement. And so the farmer, in your case, is a collaborator in the trials?
Yes, yeah, very much. So a lot of the trials has been with the growers we've had. So with the Future Proofing Vegetables project that we're working on, we've got some growers have been really, really engaged, and it's been talking to them, and they've been asking us questions and saying, what do I do here, or how can I work this, or does this work on my farm? So we're saying, let's set up a trial. And so we're setting up replicated trials. So we've got four replicates in the paddocks that we're doing the trial. So I suppose going through the whole trial design process with the farmers, but it's the the whole purpose of the trial is to give work with the farmer to make sure to give the farmer confidence that as he's making changes on his farm practice, he's not losing yield. So I suppose it's trying to take the risk out. But the farmers are going, can I do this on my farm? And I suppose giving them that confidence to ask those questions and actually test it out with the new practices.
Yeah, so you've been using the on-farm trial guide that FAR and Landwise got prepared by Peter Stone and colleagues, and that you're finding that a good template for yourself to make you think it through carefully at the start?
Yeah, definitely, because I tend to be a bit of a doer, which means sometimes you forget to check everything at the start. So that template guide is really good. It's got a really simple outline of before you start your trial, like what measurements do you need to do before you start your trial. And it's got a user guide for different crop types as well, so like for mostly your processed crops and also your arable crops. But I suppose it gives you a good outline of what things you should be looking out for, or what measurements you should be making throughout the crop. So that's been a really useful, and it's a grower-friendly guide. It's not like technical. It's basically, it gives you 10 steps of do this at the start, do this halfway through, and at the end, process your data in this way, and you get good quality information out of your trials then.
So do you think farmers are going to be jumping up and down with joy and all, throwing in lots of 10-point plans and doing hundreds of trials on their own farms?
I don't know if they're going to be all writing out a 10-point plan, but going, even like reading through the trial plan design, and when you're looking at testing something on your farm, making sure you've got the right measurements is really critical. So if as a grower you're looking, going, oh, should I set up or how should I set up my trial, going through the plan right from the start and going, what do I need to do, and mentally going through that list is definitely a really, really good start. It doesn't necessarily need to always be written out in 100% detail, but yeah. And then as you're going through that trial, making sure you take good records and actually write down the information rather than just making observations. But yeah, as you're going through the trial, the good data recording is really important.
Okay, so we've got a year to run on this project, and you'll be doing lots more engagement with farmers. Is it going to be all trials, or are there some other things that you can be using to support farmers to help them be comfortable to make changes?
It's the trials is only part of the toolbox of what we've been using. Most of the changes that farmers have or make are based on experience, and we've done trials for the last, you guys were doing, Landwise was doing the trials before I turned up, and for the last year we've done quite a few trials, and we'll be still doing more next year. But a lot of it's going, we've been doing these trials with these growers, this is the success we've been finding on these farms, how can we implement that into your business, or how can we use that across your operations? So a lot of it is based on experience and then double checking. But a lot of that, yeah, the trials is really the process as one of the tools. We've also been working on some other tools. So I think what George is going to cover next, which is like the nutrient budget templates, which is actually going through more in the planning stages of what you're doing. So looking at your nutrients before you farm your crop and go, what do I actually need? Because Horticulture New Zealand with Plant and Food put out a really good the nutrient management for vegetable crops in New Zealand guidelines. And that, like, those resources cover a lot of information about what fertilizer you need for your crops. And so I suppose, a lot of the project has been trying to get growers to make informed decisions rather than using traditional practices or what they've done for the while. But so, because most of decisions are made based on previous experiences, but in particular the nutrient management for vegetable crops in New Zealand guidelines, that's a really recent publication with up-to-date guides, which is really helpful.
Okay, well, thanks, Luke. That sounds like a really good lead into Georgia. So perhaps, Georgia, you could pick up and talk about the nutrient budget templates that you've been working on.
Yep. So in my presentation, I was talking about the nutrient budget templates, which is something that we've been developing now for a bit over 7 or 8 months. So it started as a conversation with Gisborne District Council, actually, around their farm environment planning and cropping farmers being required to submit nutrient budgets as a part of farm environment plans. And I guess we kind of could recognise that there weren't a lot of good tools available for vegetable or other cropping growers to start that process. And nutrient budgeting itself is just kind of an approximation of really complex plant, soil and environment interactions. So we kind of wanted to simplify it as much as possible into what are your inputs and outputs, and what can you measure in that process so that you can document that A, you're following recommended guidelines for fertilizer practices, but also if you want to, at the end of the budgeting process, you can actually kind of do an audit. So what were your results in terms of yield, tonnage, and your soil levels after harvest and any residues as well? And are those results supporting your original fertilizer plan and your nutrient budget that you started with?
Okay, so it's been quite a long process, and I've watched you go through I don't know how many iterations trying to get this thing sorted out. It's quite hard to start from nothing and end up with the gold-plated all singing and dancing machine. Now you've actually been using the latest version with some growers. How that you're finding the, how do they react?
It's been really positive. So last week we went out to Levin and tried it with a couple of growers. We've had input from growers throughout the whole process, but actually going through a specific crop with them and looking at what their soil test results were before they planted, and what their expected yields were going to be, and then putting those figures into the nutrient management guidelines, which is the book that Luke mentioned by Jeff Reed and Jeff Morton. That was a really good process, and growers could immediately see the value in having evidence to show that they're actually making informed decisions around fertilizer use. And vegetable growers in particular have to go through Global Gap or New Zealand Gap to sell their produce. So they really appreciate having a piece of paper to put in their folder that shows that they have definitely thought through the process and are taking account of those recognised guidelines.
Yeah, so when we began the project, we started off with a survey of growers and their nutrient management used based on the fertiliser industry guides. And we found that farmers were thinking about most things, but what they all lacked was a written, documented record of that they've gone through the process. So your new tool fills that for them.
Yeah, we hope so. Yep. It includes calculations, so it's not just, oh yeah, I've thought about the residue and I've thought about the soil test. It's a documented process that actually calculates the numbers. What is your expected surplus or deficit going to be with your planned fertilizer applications? And how does that compare with recognized guidelines? And then also at the end, the step three post-harvest assessment, how does that, those actions, that fertilizer plan and what you've achieved from it, so the yield of the crop and any residue that's been left behind and the soil levels of nitrogen or phosphorus, how does that all come together to give you a nitrogen or a phosphorus balance? So for phosphorus, you're looking at, are your Olsen P levels trending up or down? So is it likely to keep increasing with what you're doing at the moment, or is it likely to go down, which is good and bad in different situations? And then also for the nitrogen, it's about what is the level of nitrogen that we can't account for. So I guess one of the complex and frustrating things about farming is we can't measure leaching. And a lot of the time we can't measure denitrification and volatilization, so we can just measure what we can, so fertilizer, soil, residues and yield. And then once you take account for all those factors, you can kind of get a picture of what is the nitrogen remaining. And if that's a really big loss from the system, then perhaps there could be some leaching involved in that. And you can kind of do some, I guess, logic tests on your own. So if you know you had a big rainfall throughout your crop growth period and you know you had to go back and apply more fertilizer, then that's, you know, leading you to believe that there may have been some leaching throughout the period of that crop. So it just gives you the ability to kind of quantify that. And even though it can't definitively say this has been your leaching, because we're not trying to compete with Overseer at all, it's just a template to understand and document nutrient budgeting. It gives growers a bit of confidence that they're either on the right track or there's some areas for improvement.
You mentioned before it had maths in it, doing calculations. You had a week collaboration with Andrew Barber and the AgriLink crowd. What was that about?
Yeah, so Andrew from AgriLink and a colleague of his, Henry Stenning, put together a autofill template. So the nutrient budget templates are currently in an A4 PDF format, and they managed to code them so that you can fill them automatically online, through the PDF, and the template will do the calculations for you. So instead of having to plus and minus figures, it will actually calculate those results for you, so you don't have to worry about getting bits wrong, which makes it nice and easy.
Sounds like a good idea when people aren't very comfortable to multiply by percentages, I'll tell you that.
Yeah.
There's also that they rely on other tools. So you've got the online, or you've got the FAR calculator as part of the system, and you've also got the vegetable book. So the farmers are using those and getting into those and dragging the information out as they require it?
Yeah, definitely. We're finding, through introducing the templates, because growers see value in them, they're putting the effort into actually going through the nutrient management guidelines, which is the Fertiliser Association and Horticulture New Zealand book that was published that we keep talking about, to find out what those recommended fertiliser rates are for their specific crop situations and soil levels of fertility. And then also, the FAR calculator supports growers to convert nitrate quick test figures into kilograms per hectare values. So the nitrate quick test is a really great tool that we've been using a lot throughout these past year or so, 12 months. And it allows growers to immediately test the soil nitrate levels. And that result is in a parts per million concentration. So not very helpful on the surface, but the FAR quick test mass balance tool allows growers to convert that figure into a kilograms per hectare value, which is a lot more familiar for growers and also can be then used in the nutrient management guidelines.
And you're working with growers like Jay, who sort of lives and breathes computers, and you're working with growers who are not quite sure how to use their telephone. So across the spectrum of people you've met, are they happy to go online and grab information?
It depends. So I guess the original aim of these nutrient budget templates was to make it as simple and low tech as possible. So the nutrient management guidelines have actually been given out to growers in a hard copy. So they can do pretty much all of the work on paper. And probably the only thing that they would need to use online would be the mass balance tool by FAR, to convert those nitrate quick test values into kilograms per hectare. But if you've got a lab test for nitrogen, then you won't need to do that. So yeah, they're very simple. And of course, growers range in their ability and experience with tech, but that's fine. We wanted to make something that everyone can use. And we've at the moment, what we've got is great for on paper and low tech, but it's probably not great if you need to create, 10 or 15 per month. So we are definitely looking at ways to make it more user-friendly for bigger operations. So we're doing that firstly through the help of AgriLink with making autofill templates, which is great. But also we've got some help from one of John Evans' friends, who is a student, I think, a programming student working for him over the summer. So he is helping us to put it into a web app version. So then that would make it something of more of like a database where you can create these nutrient budgets, save them, and then go back to them, export their results in a CSV file or something like that. So it's a lot more user-friendly for those bigger operations, bigger growers.
Great. Thanks, Georgia. I think we might move on to Murph. So, Murph, we contacted you and said, yeah, we're dealing with nitrates. And so here we've got the organic guy, and most people think their mind goes straight to synthetic fertilisers. But you, I think, tend to think in a systems way, because partly maybe the background, or maybe you went into organics because you thought about systems. I'm not sure which order it came in. But we asked you to talk about cover crops and catch crops, and all we wanted was the simple answer. And is that what you gave us?
No, don't be stupid, Dan. There's no simple answer in organics or agriculture as a whole. So just stepping back to your comment there about nitrates and organics. I mean, nitrates are naturally occurring compounds. They are one of the two key forms of nitrogen taken up by plants. The other is ammonium. So although we apply them, both ammonium and nitrates, as fertilizers, those are natural compounds that exist in the soil and in the wider environment as well. So in organics, we're often facing similar issues around trying to mitigate those. And just because organics doesn't use soluble fertilizers doesn't mean we don't have nitrate leaching problems. I've seen some cases, particularly in Europe, where farmers ploughing up a long-term lay, say 3-4 years in autumn, they've leached 200 kilograms of nitrogen per hectare. You know, just devastating amounts of nitrogen. So everybody's problem, everybody needs to look for a solution. So jumping back to the cover crops, I was asked to talk about cover crops and nitrogen leaching, or nitrate leaching in particular, because nitrate's the main form that leaches of nitrogen. I just want to step back. Two things I want to say. What are cover crops for starters? Cover crops are the generic term that cover any kind of crop you're growing that you're not planning to make an immediate cash return on. So we talk about cash crops and non-cash crops. And so the non-cash crops include cover crops, things like green manures that we think of for fixing nitrogen, improving soil nitrogen level. But cover crops can be used for a very wide range of reasons. I've been working with FAR before Christmas on an integrated weed management handbook for addressing herbicide resistance. And I'm a well-known metalhead. I love nothing better than getting to the workshop and designing a new piece of machinery to make a solution for something. But for stuff like nutrient management, weed management, integrated weed management, cover crops can play a role in all of these, and soil health. So you don't want to just think of cover crops as a nitrate mitigation option. They're giving you a whole bunch of beneficial outcomes. So again, you know, in talking Jay's comments about getting a win-win, improving your environmental footprint, but also improving your profitability, cover crops are one of those classic kind of tools that can do that. So around cover crops and nitrate leaching in particular, what you're looking for is a crop species that is essentially going to try and mop up that nitrogen at a point in time in your cropping system that nitrogen would have the potential for leaching out the bottom. So typically we are talking about that autumn period when the soil's warm, the microbes are mineralizing soil organic matter and releasing the nitrogen from that. So you want crops that can mop that stuff up. And so the grasses, the cereals, are classics of that with their fibrous root systems, and often some of the more rugged cereals, things like oats, rye corn, and even stuff like sweet corn, maize. Maize is renowned as being a good mopper up of nitrates, and also other species such as brassicas. What is absolutely useless at mopping up nitrogen is the legumes, because they fix their own nitrogen, they've got a very poor, weak root system. It doesn't penetrate the soil very deeply. So for me, particularly around nitrates, it's looking at your farming system and going, right, when are the key point in time am I likely to be losing nitrates from my system? And therefore, I want to start working out how I can get a cover crop or a catch crop, as the nitrate leaching crops are often talked about, so they catch the nitrogen. How can I get those into my system to hold on to that nitrogen and stop it going out the bottom? The advantage there is, of course, you start addressing the environmental requirements of society and the regulators. But if you're losing nitrogen out the bottom end of your soil, that's dollars going down the drain. It's cost you money to get that nitrogen into the system, whether it's through bag nitrogen or fixation from legumes. It's money being lost. So if you're holding on to that, that can improve the profitability. Dan.
Thank you. So you wouldn't be happy to give me a simple answer, which is fine because there isn't one. I'm wondering if, as a beginner, are there obvious things to watch out? So what are the traps for young players, someone who's starting to go into cover cropping? What would be their first step, or what should they run away from, and what be the low-hanging fruit?
The first thing to get into your head that a catch crop is a crop. So you have to look after it well. You know, if you didn't put enough, you know, phosphorus, if your soil's low in phosphorus and you didn't put some phosphorus on a cash crop, you wouldn't yield very well. So the same with a cover crop. You've got to think of them as a proper crop and manage them accordingly to get the best out of them. Clearly, if you're trying to prevent nitrate leaching, that doesn't involve chucking a whole load of urea at them. So, you know, don't get into your head it's kind of something you can just chuck on the field, shut the gate, walk away and hope it's going to work okay. You've got to think about weed management, about nutrients, if they're going to come down with any pests and when you need to do anything in there. The easy kind of starting point for cover crops is the kind of traditional route for temperate farming systems. You grow your cash crops over summer, and then you would traditionally, and I'm talking now, you know, 30, 40 years ago, leave everything, plow it up over in autumn and leave everything fallow over winter. And that's kind of a recipe for disaster, as is now well understood, you know, through soil destruction. Loss of soil health, nutrient leaching because there's nothing there. So the best thing to do to start with is simply when you finish your summer crops, go, right, okay, there's a fallow period here, let's put a green manure in or a cover crop of some description to either hold on to the nitrogen or to fix some nitrogen over the winter period. The next thing I'd do is get away from the kind of monoculture mentality we've got from our cash crops. So a lot of the times we're growing monocultures because it just makes harvest and management easy. But from an ecological point of view, growing stuff in monoculture is a loser's option, essentially. By trying to mix and match different species together, we can improve the performance of the cover crop. And we do that across most of New Zealand agriculture. It's called ryegrass and white clover pastures. We've got those two species that are highly complementary in ecological terms, and growing them together results in a much better benefit than trying to grow them individually. So for me, the next thing to do would be to look at putting mixtures in, and kind of almost as much as you're brave to do. I mean, there's people growing cover crop mixtures with 20, 30 different species in them. And we've got increasing levels of ecological science to say, yes, we will still be seeing benefits with that level of a mixture compared to just having a handful of species in a mixture. But just start with handfuls. To begin with, until you get confident. A real trap is when you start getting into the kind of advanced cover cropping and you're starting to integrate your cover crops with your cash crops and things. We talk about living mulches, where you're growing something, a low growing cover crop species, and white clover would be a classic example of that. And then you're growing a much larger cash crop through it, maize, sweet corn, or any of the arable cereals would be great examples of that. The potential for a really small plant growing underneath a big cash crop for causing competitive loss in the cash crop can be really quite major. It's kind of surprising how a small, weedy, kind of insignificant looking plant growing on the ground can really hammer some of the bigger crops. And a lot of that's down to root architecture and competition at root level. We often tend to think about competition as purely above ground competing for light. In fact, most of competition, 60 probably plus percent of competition, is actually happening underground amongst the roots for water and nutrients. So if you get into that advanced stuff, that's the stuff where you can easily completely balls it up and lose an entire crop to competition.
So you sort of saying we have to do it, work it out for ourselves, which says we have to try things out. And you also said somewhere in the thing that it took a long time to see any results sometimes.
Okay,
So if I'm doing a trial, how do I do a trial where I'm going to see some results, and how would I measure success?
Yeah, okay. So any kind of ecological approach as opposed to a chemical approach to farming, everybody's mileage varies all the time. If you spray Roundup, doesn't matter whether in New Zealand, Australia, in a glass house, out in the field, the same thing happens. With ecological approaches where you're using kind of species interacting, results vary a lot. You know, so what works in Canterbury isn't necessarily going to work up in the Hawke's Bay. So you do need to do your own trials. And I mean, Luke was and Georgia were talking about on-farm trials and replication and stuff. A lot of the time for me, for the cover crops, it's not as complicated as a scientifically robust trial. It's a suck it and see. And I've known farmers that have started off down the cover crop route, and they've literally just got a bucket with a few seeds in it, gone and spread it over a few square meters of land or crop or whatever, and seen what's happened. You know, just eyeball stuff to see what's going on, because you'll pretty quickly realize, you know, if you've put a living mulch species under a cash crop, and you've just put it in a small area, and your cash crop is either looking much higher or much shorter than the rest of the field, you know what's going on. So, you know, don't overthink this stuff. And again, don't bet the farm on some of the more complicated techniques. Try small areas till you gain some confidence. And once you have that confidence after, you know, trying this on, you know, a good number of fields over several years, then you start betting the farm on the process. In terms of seeing the results, there's two things going on. Some results are instantaneous. So keeping with the theme of clover under maize, a whole chunk of the nitrogen that the clover is fixing is being directly transferred to the maize, often through mycorrhizal associations, but also through root turnover of the clover. So a lot of people think you have something like that, you're not going to see the nitrogen out of the clover to the following season. The transfer can be almost instantaneous. And some of the mycorrhizae are shunting phosphorus around between plants as well. So there's a lot of stuff happening down at root level. So something like that, you're really looking for an immediate and direct impact on your yield. In that case, you're basically going out, you're either putting, if you've done large plots, putting a yield harvester on the combine, on the header, to see what's happening, or just going out there and doing some hand, if you've got small plots, literally just going out and hand sampling, you know, pulling cobs off, putting them on the scales and seeing what's happening and checking to see what the quality is like. What we're also looking in the kind of the long-term game with cover crops is an improvement to overall soil health, one of those very generic terms. So health encompasses organic matter levels, soil biology, having an active soil biology, good soil structure. And typically where you're introducing cover crops with that longer term aim, it will take some time for soil health to improve. You're not just going to see a massive improvement in soil health the next year. So a good comparison would be with controlled traffic farming. You start controlled traffic farming and you might see, you know, a bit of an improvement in the first year as that compaction alleviates. But it's kind of when you start getting to year 3 and 4 of controlled traffic farming, you start seeing, you know, really significant gains. So again, similar with cover cropping, you're altering the soil system. Soil responds quite slowly to management changes. You know, there's hundreds of tons of organic matter a hectare, and you're adding, you know, tens or 20 ton of organic matter from a cover crop, you know, that's a small proportion you're adding. So you sometimes have a bit of a valley of death. You start your cover cropping regime, you're spending money on it in terms of buying seed and the extra tractor work and stuff, and you don't see that immediate return. So you kind of have to hold your nerve a wee bit for 2 or 3 years, and then you start seeing the return in terms of improved yield, improved nitrogen, in terms of there's more organic matter in the soil, so you've got a bigger reservoir of nitrogen, and also sorption sites for the nitrogen, the mineral nitrogen in the soil to attach to, better rooting depth, better water holding capacity, better drainage, and all those benefits you get from soil health.
So is there a role for livestock in cover cropping, and what about in the vegetable situation?
Yeah, to me, there's there's quite a lot of angst in organics around kind of using livestock for grazing cover crops. For me, it's a kind of, as Joe was saying, it's kind of what suits your system. One of the things, if you grow a really bulky cover crop, especially something over winter that's got a high proportion of cereal in it, there's going to be a lot of biomass there. And if you're trying to cultivate that back into the ground, it's going to take many weeks, probably a month or two, before that decomposes enough for you to be able to go through and start planting something in there. Even if you were using a no-till approach, you'd still have issues around nitrogen robbery. In a situation like that, break feeding this stuff off to a whole bunch of stock, doesn't matter what they are, is basically going to accelerate the decomposition of that crop in the ruminant's stomach. I mean, a rumen is basically a massive bag of microbes, and most of those microbes are the same microbes that exist in the soil. So you're just speeding up that decomposition cycle, and animals are of course putting a whole bunch of urea literally out the back end along with dung. So if you want to really turn a cover crop around quickly, there's certainly a role for animals. You will lose some some of the nutrients and the energy in that cover crop will go off in the stock, you know, whether they're growing stock or whatever, you know, it's removed. So if you're really desperate for improving soil health and stuff, you may want to say, well, actually, soil health's my bigger aim here, and I will incorporate it, or I will just mulch it and lay it on the surface. So it's, what are your objectives? What are you wanting to achieve? What is the best way of doing that? And stock may or may not be the answer.
Awesome. Thank you, Murph. What I'd like to do now is move into the sort of the question answer bit. And just to start off with, give the panelists who've given the first opportunity to take. So have any of the panelists got questions of one another? And also one of the things I'm interested in is what commonalities do you see between the different things you've talked about? Go, Jay Clark.
Yeah, found Murph's section there really, really interesting because he highlighted some points of angst for us as a real life commercial enterprise and commercial vegetable grower. Where you were talking around the organics thing, I'm going to have to take a recording of that, Murph, where you've said organics have nitrogen leaching problems too, and just keep it in my pocket so every time I see MFE, I can like record, play that back to them and give them a bit of a real world example that, yeah, organics isn't necessarily the answer for nitrogen leaching full stop, because it is the first thing that every sort of environmental group or when we've talked to DOC or we've talked to MFE, it's the first thing they say is, I'll grow everything organically and you won't have a leaching problem. And we have to inform them otherwise. So it'd be great to have actually somebody from the organics industry saying that.
It is on tape. You have it in the bag.
Thank you very much for that, Matt. Now, the next thing that I had is, look, 100% agree with all that you've had to say around cover cropping, and it's something that we use extensively at Woodhaven Gardens. So we're using maize and we're using ryegrass just in between short-term rotation ryegrass, so for 10 or 12 weeks if we're not going to get back onto land straight away. Now, we're well aware of the benefits to soil health of doing that cover cropping, and that's really why we got into it in the first place. But we've kind of been pushed to change how we're using it to, more than anything, tick a box with an overseer, because if we do, say, short-term rotation ryegrass and we just plough that back in, we get a massive negative effect on our overseer number. And then same with maize. If we were to grow a crop of maize or a crop of winter oats and we put those back into the soil, our overseer result just turns disastrous. So, and that is unfortunately the regulatory tool that we're stuck with in our region. So that becomes really, really problematic. So we kind of forced the whole time to do cut and carry options, which don't always necessarily match up with the highest leaching risk, because you say something like winter oats, people aren't interested in taking that as a cut and carry option because it's too moist, the amount of leaching involved in the amount of moisture content is too high, and they don't want to chuck it in their stack and have that on their farm. Whereas you're doing summer maize, you know, you've got a viable cut and carry option at the back. My question for Murph is, how do we get alongside regulators to help them get a better understanding of the playoff between soil health and nitrogen losses, and that just having a regulatory system that focuses solely on nitrogen losses can be detrimental to overall soil health?
Yeah, look, that's a bigger question. that's a huge question there. So just to jump back, the comment about organics, that wasn't frivolous. You know, whether it's organics or regenerative or biological, all the alternative agricultures, generally as an overall system and taking an average, we probably have lower nitrate leaching than our comparative conventional colleagues, but that doesn't guarantee that we will always have lower nitrogen leaching. We can make a complete mess of it in organics just as bad as anybody else has by doing dumb stuff like cultivating at the wrong time of year or cultivating the wrong thing. I'd fully agree around your issues around overseer. For me, there's a lot of pros and cons of doing the overseer approach, i.e. trying to work out what is really happening in a field versus, for example, the European approach, which is literally a one size that fits absolutely nobody at all, but is regulatorily very simple. It's literally checkboard, you know, how many cows, how many tons of nitrogen, etc., did go on this field, etc. The problem is when you start moving into these more uncommon approaches such as cover cropping and a bunch of other techniques as well, overseer simply doesn't have this stuff. The problem is, how do you get your fundamental question about how do you get regulators to do anything? I don't know. We've tried shotguns and that doesn't work. You know, it's the regulatory, the government systems are insanely complicated things, and it's a process of attrition. It's partly people like yourselves showing we can do this really well. You need to make the regulatory system actually work for what we're doing, because we are achieving the real aims you want. But if you force us into this, you know, uncomfortable box that is overseer, we will actually have worse outcomes. It's, you know, it's just an incredibly torturous process, and there's no great answer. And ditto when I deal with regulators and government people, and they say, how do we get farmers to do this? I say, mate, it's really complicated. So did that answer all your questions, Jay?
Yeah, thank you very much, Murph.
Very good.
Luke, you've been doing a bit of work on the nitrate leaching from pastures and things with overseer as well, and we certainly don't have an answer, but we have been having some good conversations with overseer around that. Can you make a comment on where they're at with some of that stuff?
Sorry, I'm not sure if I fully captured the question, but I think it was around the crop residues or like the pastures being ploughed in. So, like there are currently some issues with the nitrogen cycle in overseer, but as a tool, it tends to work pretty well. In the latest guidelines for overseer, they've actually finally documented and told users that are growing. So, if you're growing an annual ryegrass crop, for a cover crop, you're meant to enter it as oats, forage oats, rather than as ryegrass, and that eliminates pretty much. It means that instead of penalising you for growing it, it now shows that you do actually make an improvement. So that was one recent, the latest update, and obviously that was great. But I think.
So that was in the release about a week or so ago, wasn't it? So if you haven't been on Overseer for the last week, there are different notes there. So all of the guidelines have been put onto the latest release. There's a lot more information, and there's also some more understanding of how the thing actually works. But we did have quite a good conversation with Overseer a couple of weeks ago, and we come up with a whole lot of issues that faced vegetable growers. And they didn't have answers for everything, but they had a very open reception and were keen to explore those and take them away and study them and see what the story was. So we were pretty pleased on behalf of vegetable growers that they're aware of things and that there are bits to fix, and they're doing what they can as they can. Any other panelists got questions of each other?
I'm good.
No, not me.
Okay.
I am looking at Ian's questions here and getting very excited, though.
Yes. I've just got one little one. It's probably on George's one. It may be more of a comment, Dan, is that I know when you're talking about creating those nutrient budgets, you want to try and keep it simple, Simon, and you're doing paper-based stuff for the smaller guys. And then you were saying, right, well, you know, we may need to look at some solutions for the bigger guys. I don't think it necessarily pans out like that. And the reason I'd say that is you take a smaller grower, they're often more likely to be growing for farmers market, growing multiple crops, doing multiple sowings and plantings throughout the year. And they're going to have to capture far, far more data than, say, a really big 500 hectare lettuce grower. So those data capture solutions, they need to work for all size growers, and they can't be paper-based, because when you try and actually put that into any form of modeling tool to show a regulator, you've then got to go through every single piece of paper and chuck that back into some sort of a computer system. So if you haven't got that digitally recorded in the first place, you've got a huge problem on your hands. And we learned that firsthand doing, you know, Overseer at Woodhaven, where we did have it digitally captured, but maybe not in the right formats. And it was still painstaking hours and hours of reformatting data so that it could be in a workable format. So I think just as you're working with you know, various stakeholders to develop those tools, try and take that keep it simple Simon approach, but try and make it digital, because it's going to save a whole lot of heartache for all the growers on the back end.
Yeah, no, you raise a really good point. That's definitely true that they're going to have more plantings and potentially more crops throughout the year to consider. So that's some good feedback, and we'll definitely keep working with our programmer to try and speed that process along so that it is more digital. I guess the initial appeal of a paper-based system was that it might be good for Gisborne growers who are potentially doing less crops per year. So probably, you know, with sweet corn growers, tomato growers, they're probably only doing one crop, maybe two a year. So that would be a good option for them. But as you say, if you're looking to then input that in Overseer or another digital modelling or capture tool, that's not going to work out as well. So yeah, that's a good point. And we'll definitely keep that in mind, especially for the smaller live-in growers.
So, Georgia, while you're there, one of Ian's questions was the one around Olsen P. And
yep.
So have you got that fixed yet? Across
yes.
all of New Zealand?
No. I can actually share my screen if that might help, so that I can show the P budget, which might help explain what I wanted to show. Here it is. Cool. So what we've got here is the phosphorus budget template. So as I said, it's a three-step process. You put your admin and paddock crop information in the top. This is your fertilizer plan, and then the book's recommended guidelines. And then this would be your planned P surplus or deficit. So I guess what addresses Ian's question is, in step three, what we've tried to do is show what growers' fertiliser plan looks like when they, so the total amount of P applied minus the P exported in yield, and then that gives you an actual P surplus or deficit number. So that is how much P is being added or removed from the system based on fertiliser applied minus what you take off in yield. And then what goes on from that is dividing it by the soil rate of change. So with different soils, you need more or less phosphorus to change the Olsen P level. So for a aliphatic volcanic soil, which you get a lot in Pukekohe, there's a little bit in Levin, but not heaps, you need a lot more phosphorus, 25 kilograms per hectare of P on average, to change the Olsen P level by one unit. And with a sedimentary recent soil, which you'd get commonly around Hawke's Bay, Manawatu, two, that's quite a bit less at 10 kilograms of pea per hectare. So what that means is for growers that already have a high Olsen pea level and are looking to reduce that, if their actual pea surplus or deficit, or if their actual balance is a deficit, so it's a negative number, then they can kind of start to predict when that's divided by their soil rate of change, roughly how much is phosphorus for pea going to reduce by each crop. So if they've only got a small surplus, say 5 kilograms per hectare, then they know that this crop is only actually going to reduce their Olsen P level by half a unit. So that might be, you know, what they're aiming for, but commonly for vegetable growers, it's many, many units above what would be considered to be optimum or at the higher level of optimum. So in some ways, it's a good tool to mentally remind growers of how much deficit is required, or how much small deficit over many successive crops, how long it's going to take to bring it back to a more appropriate number. So I guess we're not saying apply no phosphorus. In fact, in step two, there's a part where it talks about trying to apply phosphorus at a rate that is lower than 100% of crop removal. So essentially applying less phosphorus than will be removed by the crop. So you're effectively mining that soil phosphorus. I think that's just a good way to remind growers that if they're actually on the opposite side of the spectrum, in that they've got an already high Olsen P value and the actual balance at the end is a P surplus, then I think that shows quite clearly that they're trending the wrong way. And in however many crops and successively, they're going to keep increasing their Olsen P by roughly 1 or 2 or 3 units, which is definitely not the aim. So yeah, I think it quite visually and obviously shows what the aim should be, and helps them plan for that strategy a bit better.
Thanks, Georgia. So Trevor's asked about Epsom, as it offered as a better tool for Overseer. Is there anyone who wants to have a stab at that one?
Yeah, I was looking at that and laughing, sorry. There's now the kind of famous statement about models: all models are wrong, some of them are useful. So all models have their pros and cons. Some will be better in some areas, some will be worse. So Epsom may be better for some bits than Overseer. Overseer would be better than Epsom for others. And so you just have to pick which one you're going with and stick with it. Nothing worse than changing models, because the difference between them is almost complete nonsense because of that they're all wrong bit. And then try and get the model you are using as good as possible. So slightly objectively as possible, I'd say the good news is it looks like the Overseer, the team working on the model itself, are actually now listening. And therefore they will start incorporating more and more stuff. What they are, however, always stymied by is there good data from empirical trials out in the field that represents real New Zealand conditions on which to base the model? And if they don't have that, the model's basically useless.
And that applies to Epsom, Overseer, Mickey Mouse, or anything else, because all if you don't have the real data, and for vegetable crops, unfortunately, we are very lacking on that. Luke, would you like a chance to make a comment about that?
I think, like, as soon as you're going to start modelling an Epsom, the cost of the growers is going to go up astronomically, and for potentially only a marginally improved modelling result. And that again depends on how much information is there. We've just started collecting information on some of the Asian brassica crops down in Levin, because we're trying to make Vertrex and trying to estimate nitrogen uptake in like your bok choy or choy sum, or like some of your Asian greens that's been sold into the Chinese restaurants. I couldn't find anything even online as far as what a typical values in crops. So we've started to do a bit of just testing to get typical yields for those crops and typical nutrient values of the plants, and also what the plants are returning back into the ground, so that we can give growers better information there. But yeah, if you don't have good information, it's you can't build a model without the data to go into it. And Epson and Overseer are two different tools. Overseer is a long term, what's the impact of your business, of your production system over the long term. Epson's more like a what happened this year. So that they are, as Murph was saying, that they are very different models that you can't really compare that well.
Hey, Dan, can I make a, just a comment on the modelling thing? And it's not just a Woodhaven Gardens, I'll put a bit of an industry hat on here from conversations with Horton Z and other various grower organisations around the country. I think in terms of understanding the leaching position for commercial vegetable growing, we need to know an estimated position for that. We need to be able to put a number on it so that regulators can put that into the, you know, catchment accounting and the like, to work out what's happening in catchments and then make regulatory decisions going forward. And that's completely understood and I think accepted by the grower community. The grower community, I don't think, has any acceptance of using any model, whether it's APSIM, I think, what's the other one, SPASMO or something like that, and then an Overseer, for day-to-day regulatory compliance. Now, there's a very good reason for that, and that's because you will end up pigeonholizing growers for things that are absolutely out of their control. So if you're growing a crop of spinach and you go and get hail and you can't harvest any of that spinach, so therefore your yield off that paddock is zero, should you then be in breach of your consent and then be prosecuted because of a hail event? And our position as growers is that should be an absolute no. Should you be penalised and be in breach of your consent if you are unable to market your product because there's a flush on spinach and you can't sell it into the market at a profitable price, and so you have to cultivate that back into the soil? Our answer as a growing community would be to say no. So our bent on models is that, yep, it has a role, and it has a role at estimating what that leaching position is in our growing systems, but that the regulatory tool should be good management practice, best management practice audits. And part of that should be looking at your FERT applied by crop versus recommended guidelines and having a look and seeing, you know, look, are you within KUI? Maybe you went over on this particular crop of broccoli because you had a larger rain event or it was colder or something else changed. And so on that one, you had to go 10% over. But on these crops here, you came in 10% under what the recommended amount was. Because what we really want growers doing is using, you know, good management practice, best management practice to produce their crops in the most environmentally efficient way. We don't want to be penalising and putting growers through a court process because of a hail event or a pest event or some sort of market conditions.
And you have been, within your company, you've instituted a lot of processes and internal audits on people, if I put it that way. The agronomists are doing a huge amount of work to try and understand what's sitting in your soil pool at any stage and do appropriate things. And you put in processes, I understand, to monitor their success rate?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So we have sort of triggers within our farm management system that give a recommended application guide for every single planting or sowing throughout a year for every single crop. Then if that total is to be exceeded, that triggers a review point. And that review point is then essentially reviewed by management. And we give a yay or a nay or a please explain. And the please explain sort of stuff might be, look, you know, we had 60 mils of rain while this crop was in the ground, and we just put the fertilizer on 3 or 4 days before, and we've gone and done a quick nitrate test, and it's showing we've only got 5 units of N left, and I've got 4 weeks left to grow this crop. I need to put more nitrogen on. And in that instance, every time, single time, we will be saying, you know, yes, there's no problem. And what that's doing is it's, you know, just putting a bit of accountability around fertilizer application decisions and making sure it is going on for the right reasons. Because the environmental effect of not putting enough nitrogen on and having a complete crop failure is way more adverse than putting on an extra 10 or 20 units to make sure that you actually get the crop to a harvestable market spec, where you're actually going to take, you know, a 70% yield off of that crop. So, yeah, we have those sort of checks and balances in place, and those are the sort of things that we believe that regulators should be focusing on, is having evidenceable processes and protocols and practices in place that can be independently audited to make sure that you're doing the most environmentally sort of effective and efficient growing process possible.
Thank you, Jay. Hoop Kirchhoffs, you've got a question there that's about two paragraphs long. Would you like to introduce that one?
Yeah. I was just wondering, you know, I mean, the N is quite complex, as we are hearing, you know, it's quite a good overview, actually. I remember a discussion at Dalrymple, you know, where some paddocks were sort of even generating nitrogen, you know, there was sort of mysteriously things happening, you know. So even the whole dynamics is very, very complex, I guess, still, you know, we know quite a bit, I guess, but you know, but then we still got the phosphor, you know, Georgia mentioned, and but even potassium is another one, I guess, you know. So I think in the end, we really want to go into a system. You know, Murph is a very system thinker, so, you know, that's sort of, so where are we at that point, Murph? You know, I mean, that's the ideal goal, I guess, you know, to bring it all in one big system where we try to understand the whole dynamics, I guess.
Yeah, look, interesting question. What I'm thinking of, whole bunch of things I'm thinking of here. One, we actually have really good understanding already of N dynamics, you know, the basic soil nitrogen cycle. And when I go and, you know, talk with growers and farmers, you know, about nitrogen management, the first thing I do is go and get the Wikipedia, you know, 101 soil nitrogen cycle up and explain, you know, how atmospheric nitrogen is converted and the four main forms it goes through, it transfers through the soil. So we have enough information to give to growers to say, okay, this is the key stuff that's happening in your soil. My better half's actually a soil microbial biologist, and she wrote a massive nitrogen review paper a good few years back. God, it scared the crap out of me. You know, the true complexity that we understand of these cycles, not just nitrogen, but phosphorus, potassium, all the rest of it, you know, we have a really good grasp. The key thing, I think, is actually picking the important bits out that you guys as land managers need to understand, so you can understand what's happening. As you say, you know, these soils were producing nitrogen. They weren't producing nitrogen. Nitrogen was moving from the soil organic matter pool. The organic matter was being mineralized and turned into inorganic forms of nitrogen, which were plant available, and then were being picked up by your nitrate quick test or whatever. So it's understanding that. And phosphorus, you know, one of the things that's been screaming in my head, not so much in growing systems, but in pastoral systems where there's little tillage, virtually all the available soil phosphorus ends up in the top 2 centimeters. And there's a lot of work done in Ireland where they have paddocks, fields with excess phosphorus due to continual slurry application. The best way to eliminate, literally eliminate phosphorus leaching from those fields was to plough the phosphorus under. So there is a need in the extent, in the few organisations in New Zealand still involved in the extension space, like Landwise and FAR and all the rest of it, to be, you know, putting the stuff together that explains this, you know, the mechanisms to you guys so you can understand it. I think in the past, chemical farming, to me, has been a little bit like farming by painting by numbers. You've got a situation, you look something up in a book, whether it's the Ag Chem manual, the fertilizer, the vegetable fertilizer guys, it says, put this on or apply this and everything ticks through. Those kind of recipe days are over. We need to actually have as land managers, have an understanding of the mechanisms, literally the engine of our farm, how it works, and whether we need to put some more oil in the water level, adjust the timing or whatever to get the results we need. And that applies to all farming systems. It doesn't matter whether it's conventional, regenerative, organic. Every, you know, a lot of the time I say organics is just conventional farming with 5% extra stuff on the top. Mm. We're still farming soil. We're still growing crops using nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium. It's, you know, there really isn't that much difference in them, you know, apart from when we get to the marketing stage where we lie our teeth off.
Mm. I couldn't agree with Murph again more. I think absolutely excellent comments, Murph. And it is the one thing that worries me with potentially the regulatory environment's desire to have these sort of 1+2=3 type documentation recipes everywhere, is that we get into a farming system that is a recipe-based system. And I couldn't agree with you more that that is the wrong way to go. We have tools available to us to make informed decisions based on what is actually happening in our soils in that point in time. And that is really where the industry needs to be looking at. It doesn't really matter if the book tells you grow your lettuce on 100 units of nitrogen, but you go and you do a test and it says, well, actually, I only need 40 because I've got a bunch of mineralization happening from the previous crop residue and I'm at time of year that's promoting mineralization. Or it might be that the crop's saying that you need 100, but your soil's in a denitrification state for one reason or another, and you're going to have to put more on. Or else you're not going to get that crop. And we've got the tools through things like the quick end test, through deep end tests, through getting your soil tests every year for your phosphate and your trace minerals and stuff like that, to manage that correctly using actual science. And I'm a big believer that that's where the focus needs to be.
As Dan's missing in action, I'm going to jump around Ian's question there around any combinations of cover crops to avoid. And this, I gave this example in the podcast of a red clover that outgrew the cash crop. In this case, it was a red clover undersown into a barley crop, and so barley's quite short. Sometimes there's some hard and fast rules. Just going back to that barley and red clover, it was one time when the red suddenly overtook. So this one farmer consistently undersown red clover into barley, many paddocks, many years, and it always worked. And there was just something, whether it was extra warm or maybe the paddock was somewhat nitrogen deficiency, so the clover had a competitive advantage, the extra competitive advantage tipped in the clover's favour. The key thing, one of the things I think of as a kind of a fairly hard and fast rule is all the grasses, whether it's pasture grasses or cereals, the fibrous root systems of the grasses is very competitive. This is why we want to eliminate the grasses in particular from underneath perennial crop systems like vines and apples and stuff, because they compete very strongly with those shallow feeder roots. So one of the things is if you're using a grass as a complementary or a companion crop to a cash crop, you really want to be looking very hard and trying to figure out how competitive it is likely to be. But so much of this is with this kind of companion type cropping is around the relative competitive powers of the different species and when they're planted. And there are almost no kind of really hard and fast rules there. Is kind of getting some general principles, understanding the general principles, and then trying stuff. So you can certainly find some bets that are more likely to be, you know, come through and win, and some that are likely to be complete shockers, but you can never guarantee it.
Thanks, Murph. Luke, you've got your hand up. And your microphone turned off.
Sorry for that. I was just going to raise a point to what Jay was saying. I couldn't agree with him more. And so like the revised nutrient management guidelines for vegetables in New Zealand book, actually the one advantage of that, it does include soil tests in there. So now you can account for the amount of nitrogen for a lot of crops. It's got the recommendations for both winter and summer for different nitrogen soil test levels. But then coming back and doing pre-site addressing nitrogen tests with those nitrate quick tests or a deeping test is really critical when, at times you do get those, like a soil, if you plough it in, say, a straw into your paddock, you're going to have a lot less nitrogen becoming available than if you plough it in an old broccoli crop residue. So, yeah, definitely couldn't agree more with what Jay was saying before.
Trevor, Jay, you got a comment on that?
Trevor's question about Epsom, I was
looking at your hand, it was up, but it's gone away now.
I think I left it up, but well, I will just come back to the specific point that Ian made around, because he's given a specific number saying Olsen P levels of 100 plus are an environmental concern, and how is this being addressed by growers. Olsen P is not, well, phosphate management in vegetable production is not as simple as just saying, right, well, you've got an Olsen P number and that means you can grow this crop or that crop. There's a lot of other things that are happening in the soil that relate to how much phosphate is actually available to the crop. So your trace mineral balance, so how your different trace manager, the ratios of your different trace manager minerals in your soil are really, really important to gaining access to that phosphate. And then there's also things in terms of phosphate retention in the soils that will mean potentially not all the phosphate is available to the plant. So you will have various levels of Olsen P across various paddocks in order to be able to crop them effectively. I think to George's point that she made earlier, the real important thing is to look and see, are you mining phosphate or are you sort of stockpiling it? And we don't ever really want to be in a position where we're stockpiling phosphate for no good reason. So having those trend analysis tests done every year, where you know you're getting the same bisect of samples taken throughout the paddock, and you can monitor that year on year on year and see how your phosphate levels are trending, is really, really important. And then tying that into your phosphate management. So not just being focused on an individual number and saying, well, I need it to be 80. You may not need it to be 80, or that it's a real problem if it's at 100 and I shouldn't have it at 100. You may need that paddock to be at 100 given what's going on in that soil structure.
Thanks, Jay. That leads a little bit to Trevor's other question about why are low-cost sensors and IoT not being pushed more to keep track of things in real time. I've got some thoughts on that one, but does anyone else want to have a go?
I have to say, I've had exactly the same question. You know, all the robotics and the computer guys have been saying, oh, this stuff's going to be so cheap, you're going to have sensors everywhere. I want to know why I'm still paying hundreds of dollars for a basic temperature and humidity sensor. Dan.
Can I jump in, Dan, and just talk about real-world application to this? Because this was something that Chris Claridge from Potatoes New Zealand really pushed hotly, and him and I debated it to and fro at length. If we're using sensors, at the moment they're at a cost rate. It could, you know, Murph just sort of turned around and said that are so high that you would be able to have one or two per farm. And in reality, in vegetable cropping, you know, you need one or two per hectare. Your variance across your paddock can be huge in terms of fertility, and then you need to be sort of monitoring that and managing it accordingly. So what's going on in my 2 hectares of lettuce might be completely different to my 4 hectares of cabbage that I've got right next door, or the 3 hectares of celery that I've got next door to that. And one individual sensor is not going to give you the ability to manage your farm system appropriately. That's why being able to use a system like the Quick End Test, where you can take multiple samples across a paddock really quickly and then cheaply get a look at what's going on, is a far better option for the time being. Now, whether you can then get a robot in the future that drives along my paddock and takes those samples for me so I don't have to pay someone, that would be a fantastic addition. But for now, compared to static sensors in one location, that's a far better environmental management tool.
I'll basically add to that. I just think that you're underestimating the number of sensors you need per hectare. So if we're trying to manage a crop for water, we would not really want to drop below 3 sensors per irrigation zone that we're trying to manage. And water's quite easy to manage relative to nutrients. If you're trying to track something like leaching, the number of sensors you need is horrendous. And it depends who you listen to and on the variability of the soils and the paddocks and things like that. But I've seen some reports that said you need 50 sensors per hectare to actually get a reasonable look of what's really going on. So I'll challenge your capital expenditure budget to meet that, Jay. I think the other thing is that we haven't found low-cost sensors that are worth even polluting the world with. The ones we were involved with, the potatoes research using terolytic probes that Jay was referring back to, they were leading edge, world-class stuff. They didn't work, and they were very, very expensive, but even installing them was tricky. So that's part of the issue. So there's a lot of attraction for the concept. We have looked at cheap water sensors, and really the only cheap water sensor that we found that we would bother looking at costs about $350 for the sensor unit plus whatever goes on top of it. So I'm not sure, Trevor, you may have more experience at these things than we've had, but we haven't found stuff yet. Nitrate sensors started about $5,000 a pop. So they're ready for water, not for soil. So it's quite tricky. That would be my only thing. All right. It's actually knocking on 2:30 if it's not gone past it. So at that point, what I'd like to do, unless someone's got something very desperate, I'd like to wrap up. And so just really want to thank the presenters who not only were here today and contributing and being involved, but also did the original podcasts, which also took them away from their normal activities. And they were brilliant podcasts. I'm really delighted to have those as the first set of LandWise things we had to offer to people. So the four presenters in particular, thank you for that. And thank you, Lord, to Georgia and Luke, because they've been doing a lot of work organising all of this stuff. And it's a lot harder to organise a virtual conference than a real one, it turns out. Certainly a lot more work. So thanks to you lot and all you people who decided to dial in today. We were not sure who would want to listen to us, and we got a lot. So we're really pleased about that. So thanks, everybody. And we'll be doing this again in about a month on a slightly different topic. Thank you.
Indeed. Thank you, Dan, and everybody for organising.
Yeah, thanks, Dan. Cheers, mate.
Thanks. See ya.
Thank you.
All right. So we'll sign off. Cheers.